Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. Hi there, good to be with you. Well, this week is National Reconciliation Week around Australia. And this evening on Sunday night, we thought we'd reflect on one of the most debated aspects of Indigenous relations in the country, the role of the missions, those largely church-run institutions that functioned across the nation as a point of primary contact between black and white cultures for over a century. Names like Unabilla, Hermansburg, Kalumburu, Presbyterian, Lutheran and Catholic, the legacy of the missions. Much has been said and written of the Christian missions' role in the destruction of Aboriginal cultures over the past century, as vehicles for assimilation and transition stations on the path to oblivion, particularly the way in a pre-1960s society infused with notions of cultural superiority, the missions acted as agents of the racially discriminatory welfare policies of the states and Commonwealth, participating in the evil that we came to know as the Stolen Generations. And it's not enough to say such policies were well-intentioned. Their tragic impact lingers, notwithstanding the Rudd government's national apology. Yet there is another story, and it's perhaps only now, looking back on the legacy of the past 30 years, that some are beginning to reassess the role of the missions in conserving and preserving at least some elements of Aboriginal heritage from the wider impact of Western culture, seen in the years since and culminating in the horrors revealed by the Little Children of Sacred report. Well, now we have the intervention, and perhaps another wave of well-intentioned paternalism. So tonight, we turn to another time and generation to see if something can be distilled from that experience. Is there room for reconciliation with the missions? It's a pleasure to welcome into the program Graham Mundine. Graham, good to have you with us again.
Good, thanks, John.
Graham's the Executive Director of Aboriginal Ministries for the Catholic Diocese of Sydney. Also joined in our studio by Trevor Leggett. Trevor is the General Director of Australian Indigenous Ministries, formerly long known as the Aborigines Inland Mission. Trevor, good to have you with us.
Thank you, John.
And on the phone, Dr. Norm Sheehan. Norm is at Swinburne, responsible for Swinburne Centre of Indigenous Knowledge, and working closely with Link Up and the Stolen Generations Alliance. Dr. Norm Sheehan, good to have you with us.
Good evening, John. How are you?
Terrific. And a particular welcome to our next guest, Dr. Bill Edwards. Bill is the former superintendent of one of the great Aboriginal missions run by the Presbyterian Church. Norm was the former superintendent of Unabilla. Bill Edwards. Bill, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, John, and greetings to other members of the panel.
Now, a little later on in the program, we shall be joined by some others who are going to participate by way of the phone from long distance. But let me ask first, Graham Mundine, you're somebody who's grown up in a different generation from the mission generation. What's the general feeling you have when the topic comes up?
Sure, John. I, of course, never lived on a mission, but it's important to say, I suppose, that missions did actually protect a lot of Aboriginal people from the point of there are a lot of terrible things that were happening out in these communities. Stories about people riding through on horseback with rifles and shooting Aboriginals left, right and centre, and even to the extent I've heard stories of having their heads chopped off and using those heads as polo balls and things like that. So they were a haven in amongst all this terrible stuff that was happening out there. There's no doubt that there was a lot of damage that was done during that time, that whole loss of language and culture that happened during that time as the Westerners tried to impose their culture upon the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So it's... as someone said just earlier, there it's a two-edged sword, some good things and some bad things. But probably one last thing to say, John, too, that with the loss of culture, too, in a lot of these places, it was important that the churches, or one thing I think that the churches gave those people who were affected was a sense of the spiritual, to remind them that to be truly an Aboriginal person, I think, you have to be a spiritual person.
Trevor Leggett, you're associated with one of those organisations that decided to change its name over the years. And the reason for the changing of the name is significant, is it not? There is a recognition there that something was not quite as it should have been.
Oh, I think you're right, John. In fact, that name change filtered from the ground up, as it were, in that some of
the... So it's the old Australia Inland Mission, as I think it was called, or the Aboriginal Inland Mission. The AIM, and it's now known as Australian Indigenous Missions.
Australian Indigenous Ministries, yeah. And I guess that indicates what we say is a change in our whole philosophy of operation, in that now more so we're looking to listen to the people we're working with and working with them rather than just being the old mission that did as they thought was appropriate.
What was wrong with the old days from your view? I mean, what lessons do you take out of that?
It's hard to focus on the wrong things, but there was a lot of things that were right. But some of the things that we wouldn't do today, as far as the mission was concerned, there didn't seem to ever be an interest in learning language, in using people's language for sharing gospel truth and bringing people on in their own language. And I think that was a big detriment. And we were slow to recognise and acknowledge leadership within their own Aboriginal Christian communities as well.
Norm Sheehan, let me bring you into the conversation here now. You're somebody who's been closely associated with Link Up and the Stolen Generations Alliance. When the issue of the missions is brought up or discussed in those circles, what's the tone of the discussion? Negative, positive, bit here, bit there? How does it run?
It's a bit of both. The missions came about, the ones that I deal most closely with are in Queensland, and they came about through the work of the Aborigines Protection Society from about the 1830s onwards. That Protection Society lobbied to protect Aboriginal people from attack, because the attacks were happening on a regular basis.
So it was initially a humanitarian impulse that got that?
Initially it was, and the first missions here west of Brisbane at Cherbourg was run by the Aborigines Protection Society in its first few years. The churches then took over. I sort of look at those times as the reason so many groups survived was those... the protection policy in its early years. But I think when I think about the culture of those places and the sorts of cultures that, were promoted as an institutional culture, I think we need to understand that cultures are groups trying to make sense of things, and quite a lot of domination and cultural genocide and other practices are made sense of and are institutionalised. And dominance is a difficult thing to do, and it's stressful to dominate another group. So cultures tend to develop ways of easing that dominance and easing the stress of dominating others. And it's also true that there's cultures of resistance, and there's a whole lot of work that looks at the weapons of the weak and how people respond to dominance and how cultures change under dominance. And it's quite a complex interaction, some of it being very positive. But if you look at the weapons of the weak, a lot of the features of Aboriginal communities that are described as sort of, the pathologies of Aboriginal communities can be seen as weapons of the weak as well. They're responses that allow people to cope. Severe trauma. So I think overall the missions are complex, just as complex as today's issues. Some of the events are good. There's been some marvellous things happen and some marvellous people fighting for the protection of people. But also the idea that the ideas of eugenics, of improving the stock of Aboriginal humanity, very destructive as well.
Bill Edwards, let me bring you into the conversation here. We've got an impressionistic overview, but you're somebody who was very much involved. You were you're a former superintendent of Ernabella, and look, here I will take a liberty, folks, and we should congratulate Bill Edwards. Bill is now in his 80s, and last year Bill got a PhD at the University of Adelaide. So Bill, congratulations on a life still being well lived. Bill, let me ask you, as a superintendent, or a former superintendent of Ernabella, to what extent were you aware of the cultural tensions around the policies that were being that you were implementing, and aware that policies needed to change or alter when you were in that role?
Yes, John. In fact, 3 years ago, it was 50 years since I first went to Ernabella, and I spent 20 years or so in that area. And I wrote a paper then on just reflecting on 50 years of changes in Aboriginal policies and practices. One of the things I pointed out in that there wasn't much nexus between policies and practice. And that was one of the problems of a lot of government policies, and still is, that the problem of actually implementing policies. We worked, of course, in that era of assimilation. But the particular work I was in at Ernabella, the Presbyterian Board, under the guidance to some extent in the initial stages of Ernabella of Dr. Charles Duguid, favoured a policy of in no way condemning the culture, of allowing the people to retain traditional practices at the same time as introducing the gospel, introducing our forms of education and health services. To some extent, we came under criticism, and I remember great debates with government administrators at the time, especially from the Northern Territory, who were very keen on what we term social engineering. So we had our problems dealing through that era.
So you were still dealing with a government that was fairly recalcitrant in those areas?
Yes, they were very strong on assimilation. We faced criticism because, in fact, our school started on a policy of vernacular education, and that continued for many years. And it was interesting, of course, that Don Dunstan, when he became Minister for Aboriginal Affairs, took that mission policy to be the policy of the state. But here again, it's an area where a state made a clearer policy, that you had people who had been trained in a counter policy, and it was very difficult for the government to follow the policy that the mission had actually carried out for many years.
Because the government bureaucracy was entrenched in the old policy, the assimilationist policy.
That was the problem. And if I could take up a point that Trevor mentioned earlier, in fact, missions were very much to the fore. There were some missions that condemned traditional culture and language and tried to eradicate. But if you look at the whole history, and this is something I've been doing in my doctorate, which I completed 3 years ago at Flinders University, not University of
Adelaide. I do apologise.
Okay. And in fact, you go back to the beginnings here in Adelaide, where I'm speaking from, and the early Lutheran missionaries, Teichelman and Sherman, worked in the Kaurna language, and Kaurna programs now in Adelaide, at the University of Adelaide and so forth, are dependent on the materials that they wrote and published back in 1840. And that was the situation in New South Wales, Lake Macquarie, with Lancelot Threckle, and in some of the other parts of Australia. Actually, missionaries were doing some very early Aboriginal language work.
The whole concept of nursing a culture gently into oblivion, to what extent, we can see it in government policy, in the assimilationist policy, but to what extent was a gentler version of that still pervasive in church missions? I'd ask you all that, up until, say, the 1960s. Bill, starting with you.
Yes. In fact, when you talk about missions now, of course, as far as I know, there are no missions existing. And if I can make one point that's important, I think, in this revision of mission history, quite often the idea of mission suffers because so many places are referred to as missions, and it's implied that they were church institutions, but they were actually, in fact, government stations. Schoenberg is an example. It stemmed from a very, very early mission movement nearby, but Schoenberg was a government settlement. And this was a case in many places, so often there is confusion in the history writing. Mm. Often Aboriginal people themselves use the term mission because it became entrenched as a term to refer to Aboriginal communities. In our particular case, at the Presbyterian missions, there was a policy going back to the late 60s, early 70s, of transferring control to the Aboriginal people, incorporating their communities. And this we did at Ernabella, Mowanjum, and other communities. We've faced problems in Queensland because of the Bjelke-Petersen government. They said if you hand over, you hand over to the government, not to incorporated Aboriginal communities. So I'll just make this clear. The places that are often referred to as missions are now incorporated Aboriginal communities, or perhaps they're still run by some government institution.
Norm Sheehan, just reflecting on what Bill said there and picking up on my observation about to what extent was this policy of nursing cultures into a gentle oblivion still deeply entrenched, particularly as Bill has referred to the Queensland situation?
Yeah, the Queensland situation was quite different. There's a huge amount of data here in the state records that show that, well, there was, in a lot of the missions in Queensland, there was sort of a joint administration with the Aborigines Protection Board and church groups combining to administer most of the missions here in different ways. There's sort of different degrees of that in each site, but generally what you have in Queensland is statements right up to the 1940s where you know, easing the dying pillow for a past primitive race, is a common statement. And in Queensland, even after the Second World War, the Aborigines Protection Board developed a castes register between 1946 and 1954 that listed every Aboriginal person in the missions and their blood quantum. Those sorts of practices were very strong here. You know, at the same time as the Nuremberg trials were taking place, the sort of practices that were constituted a main part of those trials.
Do you put that down? Can I just tell you, I'll just shorten the conversation a little. Do you put that down to a principal government intervention? And was there any tension between government and church in your experience, or were they all on the same page?
Well, I think that there's a complex situation where you have people who believe in humanity and people who are following an institutional code, if you like.
Yes.
Institutions don't deal with people well. You know, we had a reunion at Schoenberg, Link Up Queensland, and had a major reunion at Schoenberg a couple of weeks ago. It was a great success. Over 200 people who were ex-residents of the dormitories on Schoenberg mission. And that system, the dormitory system, and the institutionalisation of whole families is something that's, in some places, still devastating, still requiring counselling, still requiring healing, still requiring people to get together and find family who are missing. So, you know, it's not a past thing.
Yes.
It's actually a continuing
thing. It continues.
And it's generational too, isn't it? It's Graham here. Yes. It's generational too, like... In the Catholic Church's response to the Royal Commission, one thing that we did was to go and have a look at some people's records. And here in New South Wales, we went to have a look at some records here. and we were given a stack of records to go and sit in the corner and read them. Of all the nine records that I had in my hand at that time, they were either prominent Aboriginal community people, or they were related to me. And yet none of my immediate family were ever taken away. But to sit down and see that, how close it came, even to a person like myself.
So the shadow is still there on your own life.
That's right. Yeah. And it's also handed down from generation to generation.
Trevor.
Just comment about the interaction with government departments and our organisation, because it's the one I know most, I suppose. And we've still got extant communications from the founder, Retta Dixon, or Retta Long as she became, pleading the cause for the dignity of the Aboriginal people with whom they were being asked to work. And it was a constant battle with government agencies struggling through to push a point of view which was being disregarded by and large.
I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation right now, and that's Shane Blackman. Shane's of the Uniting Aboriginal and Islander Congress. Shane, welcome to the program. Good to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Shane, you've heard a little of what's said. One of the things we've teased out is there was a difference between government policy and, in some cases, the policy being followed by those church mission stations. Do you see it that way, and do you think there are some positive aspects to that legacy?
I think that there's a lot of negativity that stems from the past, but there are some good things, I think, that have some lasting legacy as well. And one of those things from that time, I think, was around the educational programs that may have been delivered in some of the missions. And when you look back and you see the strength of leadership in the midst of all of the negativity that was a part of the legacy, you see that there were some really strong people who could communicate well around the issues that needed to be addressed, and stood firm on the issues, and really, I think that was part of what enabled people to develop some hope that there would be some better future, even in the midst of all of the problems that existed.
Somebody suggested to me the other day that one of the benefits of the missions was, yes, they supplanted an Indigenous culture, but it was supplanted by a culture that at least had some authority structures. And once the missions disappeared, and the wake of the last 30 years, is that the people have lost the old authority structures. So whilst you replaced an Indigenous authority structure with a mission-based authority structure, then you got a complete collapse of any authority structures. And one of the things that has to go on at the moment is the capacity for people to recover their own traditional authority structures and to have those properly recognised. Shane?
Yeah, I think that there is a... there is some hope of some renewal of some of the social cultural structures that continued through those people who had that resilience, and also the knowledge and the ability to maintain and share the cultural understandings and knowledge and laws, I guess, from the previous enduring history. But I still think that there was a huge impact obviously, where there was deliberate undermining and diminishing of the cultural and social structures that existed.
Graham, you wanted to comment on something Shane was saying there?
You've lost me.
Oh, yeah, Trevor.
Just picking up on what Shane said about the education that many of the folk got through that institutional system, despite the negatives, my observation is that what it did, it produced leaders for the churches, for those generations that followed on in that immediate time. One of the critical issues that we're facing today is that, by and large, those folk are getting quite old and going to the Lord, and we just face a critical time where there haven't been those successive folk brought on to be leaders in the secular world as well as in the church.
Mm. Bill Edwards.
Yes, I'd support Graham's comment there. It was interesting, the first National Aboriginal Conference, I think it was, going back into the 70s, the number of people elected at that who had gained their training in church institutions, people from Mount Margaret Mission in Western Australia and other places, and even people like Pat Dodson and Gregor Yunupingu, a lot of the leaders in the movements of that era actually had training in some of the, certainly mission schools and then other seminaries and other institutions. Another point to follow on from that, when I went to Annabella, we only had 7 staff members. Two of them were engaged in sheep work, one in general mechanics and rouseabout, one teacher, one craft worker, one nurse, and then I was superintendent covering a range of things. We had about 400 to 500 people. If you go to places like Annabella now, you'll probably find there are 20, 30, 40 staff. Other institutions that have come in to provide specialist services, still about the same population. And one of the points about this, often missionaries are described as being autocratic, making all the decisions. There was a lot of personal interaction between myself and Aboriginal men and women, between the teacher and her aides. And I think this is often overlooked, and it was through that a lot of these future leaders gained their training. A point I sometimes make, I'm sometimes suspicious of a lot of training programs in Aboriginal communities now, because their way of learning was what I term the apprenticeship role. They'd learnt by working with somebody, following their model. That worked in the church.
Yes, it's something that I think Professor Peter Sutton made in his book, The Politics of Suffering, that in those days you had people who stayed, they gave their lives to the place, they were there. Mm. Then in the 60s it gradually transformed to a sort of transitional culture that people came in for a few years and went on. So there was no real sense of commitment and joining into the family, as it were.
Yeah, and one did become a member of the family, in a sense. You were given relationship terms, and, I mean, we still have very close relationships, and other former staff still maintain those relationships with the people we live with 50-odd years ago.
Norm Sheehan, do you want to comment on that?
There's actually some stories here from Berger Mission, west of Brisbane, that we collected part of the history about the school teacher there who actually broke the state law by teaching people like Neville Bonner above the grade they were permitted to teach them, and really built leadership that way. What we deal with as a link-up deals with, and I deal with through Swinburne, through the research, we're just doing connection building research, very basic connection building, because one of the things that I don't think that people acknowledge is that, you know, disease and poor health are the main causes of disruption for Aboriginal people. You know, the burden of disease is quite incredible, considering that, you know, most of us will take a sickie. If your burden of disease is 2 or 3 times what the normal Australian is, you're limited in a lot of ways. And I think that... there's ideas that are around that can help us, and one of those is the idea of syndemics, which looks at how conditions are built where one population will experience disease more than another. And I think one of the biggest things is dispossession. You know, people can be Aboriginal and they can have Aboriginal culture, but there is no place where they can experience that. Mm. Most of the sites that are important for that sort of knowledge and for the authority and law that comes from it are taken by other peoples. And so, you know, there needs to be safe places as well. One of the things that we focus on in our work is developing culturally safe places where people can experience cultural strength. And those things sound like big words. When you actually do it on the ground, it's quite simple things of people getting together, like Bill said, and acting like a family and sharing.
I'd like to explore that in a little more detail a little later on. But Shane Blackman, before we let you go, have you any response to what's been said? But also, do you take any lessons from the past and apply them or reflect on them in the light of current government policy, particularly regarding the intervention?
Look, I think that if we don't learn lessons from the past and apply those lessons to our present-day situation, we're... be very, very wrong in terms of just making criticisms.
So, what would be the priority for you in the current intervention debate?
I think that the key thing is to enable people to take responsibility. At the end of the day, I think that unless people have the right to negotiate a future for themselves. Then you're always going to be the recipient of somebody else's goodwill and therefore dependent upon the continuation of that goodwill, because all of the principles and resources that underpin that are attached to you actually agreeing to somebody else doing something on your behalf. I think that along with responsibility comes rights, but those things need to be balanced out, and I think that for me, one of the key elements of it is the removal of the right to negotiate in this whole business of intervention, where you have a group of people making decisions and then another group actually implementing those decisions, and then right down the bottom of the tree is those who receive the a supposed outcome for their benefit. I think that one of the major issues for all of our people is really to grab a hold of the education system and start to ensure that we elicit from the education system the capability to lay platforms and foundations for building a better future. And I think that out of this present-day intervention process, where somebody else holds the whip hand and those who are supposed to be the beneficiaries are still the recipients of policies that relate to the past in a lot of ways, really ought to be given the clear right to negotiate and then take responsibility for implementing the change themselves.
Shane Blackman, thanks for joining us on Sunday night. Good to have you with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Graham, did you want to make an observation?
No, I was going to say I'd even go further. I think it's pretty poor development policy that the government is... Well, it's not pretty poor, it's pretty stupid development policy that the government is implementing at the moment. We don't want to keep Aboriginal people in as they were, you know, 100, 200 years ago, but it's up to them to decide on what things that they of their culture that they want to keep and what things that they may want to let go. But it's for them to decide, not from someone who's from outside.
Trevor?
I think one of the issues we've got to face, really, is if, is we've created six generations of a dependent mentality, and it's really hard to change that thinking from both sides. And
do you think that dependent mentality was there in the mission culture, or do you think the mission culture was actually helping overcome that?
Well, I don't think either way necessarily. Right. It's just something that when you've got such a dominant culture being imposed on another culture, and for generation after generation, there hasn't been the consultation with Aboriginal people asking them what their perspective is and what they want. And I think it's just being perpetuated with this intervention. The whole business with the government, it seems to want to provide umbrella solutions. And umbrellas don't work because you need different solutions for different places.
Let's shift the conversation into this contemporary arena now. We're joined by somebody who's living in the situation, in the heart of it, literally. Jackie Baxter in Alice Springs. Jackie, thanks for joining us. And you're somebody who's experienced the day-to-day grind of trying to change policy and develop policy. Thank you for joining us.
Good evening.
Jackie, you've heard some of the conversation this evening. Have you any observations about where things stand now and what the legacy is of that old culture that needs to be some of things good, some things bad, and where we need to go at the present?
The gentleman that just spoke last.
Yeah.
He was talking about each different area needs to be identified. The first thing is, because I live in Alice Springs and the Northern Territory actually comes under the federal system. And previously the missions and institutions were set up by the states, various states. So each state had their own policy, as we all know, and they all had different conditions for their people. And what's getting caught up in today's society, which has led to this big intervention, is that everybody's saying, you know, the federal government is accountable for all Australians. But up until, you know, not so long ago, each state was responsible for their own Aboriginal people. And a lot of the time, the states aren't being held accountable for constituents.
Yes, for their past actions and activities.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
When you look at the situation today, you're connected with the town camps in mm-hmm. Alice Springs. Is there a heritage there for good or ill that you trace back to the mission culture?
Yes, because a lot of the people that live on town camps, they're actually people that came in from town, and they actually lived in the creek beds, and a lot of people were brought in. They were put at the bungalow, which was like a holding centre, which was a mission in its own right. People brought their kids in for school and put them at an institution here called St. Mary's, and that was for schooling, and that was a form of a mission. And then those people have grown up. They've hit their 18. There's no jobs, so they've come out and they've then become in the cycle of town camps. For a lot of people stay in town, but the town camps and fringe dwellers. And as the town's grown, the town camps now are part of the town, and that's what's created a lot of this intervention.
What are the positive... Do you think the intervention's a good thing or a bad thing?
I don't like it.
And why not? Give us the reason.
Oh, very clearly. One thing is that people aren't determined, so... If you live on a town camp, right, automatically you have to go on a basic card. And it's just like a ration card. And I keep arguing that there's no support mechanisms. Okay, some people can't budget their money, but there are other people that can budget their money. And
it's too much of a one-size-fits-all solution.
That's right. But also, there's no mechanism in place to get people off of the basic card. Like, there is no budgeting programs or managing money programs that are actually specific for the people in the Northern Territory. There are overarching programs that have been developed, but there's nothing that's specific. So it's a continuous cycle.
So it's all right to say, this is Graham Mundine here, and say, it's all right to say, let's get them into schools and get them educated so we can get them, you know, employed at the other end, when a lot of them would already see that there's no employment at the other end already.
You could say that. Mm. I try to use myself as an example every time I talk, so I'm sorry if I do that. Yeah. I run an office. It's a $1.5 million corporation. I also live on a town camp. I left my job 8 months ago. I went into Centrelink, and I got told I have to sit on the basic card. Now, for the last 15 years, I have been running government programs and writing government programs, yet I still have to be, and I can't get an exemption because of where I live.
Mm. If it happened in any other aspect of our society, there would be people with armies of lawyers behind them lining up to fight a basic civil liberties case and civil rights case.
Correct.
Why do you think people still retain this attitude towards Aboriginal culture? That is, it's regarded as a separate culture. In some ways, it seems that the white society still retains the old mission culture in its desire to administrate, despite the fact that that mission culture is actually on about something different.
Do you want me to say something?
Yeah, great.
I would say, like, I mean, there is a lot of racism that's involved in all this, this whole power of whiteness. And I'm not just talking about missions in that sense. I think it's in Australia's society, because I've noticed whenever you begin to talk about Aboriginals, people begin to turn off. Yet you start to talk about any other cultural group in this country and they're all come alive and, you know, want to save people left, right and centre. So I think it's quite inbred in the Australian people. There's been a bit of a discussion recently, it's started now, conversation about changes to the Constitution. People don't even realise how racist the Constitution is, not just from a point of view of Aboriginal stuff, but also for mainstream Australia, no matter where they come from.
Jackie Baxter, thanks for the observation you've made. We might let you go unless you've got another comment or two to make.
I just want to make one last comment.
Yeah.
And this is a pretty serious one. And this is broad spectrum. Australia is not going to get anywhere until they start treating all their constituents equally. And we've just come out of Reconciliation Week. Now, I haven't seen anything that's going to reconcile this country. I can't see anything that's going to unite non-Indigenous and Indigenous. I can't see anything, really, that's going to unite even men and women in this country. I mean, for reality, Australia has that many programs, and I'm a woman, I live on a town camp, so they have that many programs for women and children and families, but Australian government does not have a policy on men. They do not have anything. So until they start treating our men the same as they treat our women and give them the opportunities and support families, we're not going to get anywhere.
Jackie Baxter, thanks for your observations.
Thank you.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. We've been talking about the legacy of the missions, whether or not the old mission culture may have been misunderstood by many, that the churches had one policy, the government's another, and in fact, the legacy of the worst of mission culture may hang around in white culture in Australia. Norm Sheehan, what's your observation on that?
Well, I enjoyed hearing what I was hearing. One of the things that I've sort of been in the back of my mind and thinking about a lot is tracking this idea of the intervention. I was actually a lecturer of Indigenous Studies when the Howard government started talking about this intervention in terms of child abuse. It's actually probably the most toxic subject that you could encounter as a teacher of any kind. Because, you know, just to talk about that subject in public is quite dangerous, because there's many people who have suffered from it and never spoken about it. And so it's a charged subject that was used to frame this whole intervention.
Yes.
And in that way, I found it, my biggest concern was my 200 students in classes at that time were 99% young white Australian kids who were really, really traumatised by this type of debate. And I think that there's something in that is sort of a strange sort of mixture of pride and shame among white Australians, and that is that there's this incredible pride that they've built this wealth. But there's that, you know, hidden shame the way they have built it. And that's something that we all have to face, that there has been a huge amount of damage done to people that continues to be re-perpetrated in different ways in different generations. So I think, you know, what Jackie said about this idea of equality extending out to a whole lot of areas, I think that that's probably the only answer we can have where we look at these issues from the broadest spectrum of rights that we can possibly conceive.
It's something for all of us to be concerned about. We got a call on the line from Nicholas, who lived on the Lockhart River. Nicholas, thanks for joining us. You have to keep it brief, I'm afraid.
Okay, that's fine.
What would you like to say?
Back in 1980, my mother was a fourth certificate nursing sister, and she got a job up at Lockhart River. And my sister and I joined her up there, and we lived up there for about 18 months. And we saw, look, we had a wonderful time up there ourselves as young children. But my mother was coming from Newcastle. She was right in the Labor Party and everything. And anyway, there was a couple of Aborigines up there, Mick and Blade and Mino, who were teacher's aides. And they were quite intelligent men. And the subject of the Labor Party came up. And the talk of they wanted to start up a Labor seat in Lockhart River, and which obviously would have spread to other missions up in Queensland. And at the time, Joe Biocchi-Peterson with the gerrymander and everything, and that brought it down a lot of trouble on my mother. And like they subjugated my sister and I to police harassment, and we were arrested for non-existent charges. I was escorted off the mission. I was only 15 at the time, escorted off the mission in handcuffs by a shotgun, and it was horrendous up there at the time. The government actually controlled the missions more so than what any religion did.
That's an extraordinary story, and we'll have to pick it up elsewhere because we've only got a couple of minutes left. Bill Edwards, let me bring you in very briefly. You've heard much of the discussion this evening. Is there any lessons for you? And you think of the positive aspects of going back into missions today, like Erna Bella Compass was there for ABC TV a little while ago, and there's an extraordinary positive atmosphere. It seems to run against what we're hearing about the intervention.
Of course, the intervention doesn't apply to Annabella now as it's in South Australia, and I wouldn't, from Adelaide, want to pontificate about the intervention. I think it was badly introduced. I think there was need for some measures, but it was introduced too forcibly at the time. One of the problems, though, go back to my days at Annabella, the school attendance was about 100%. Most of the people were working in the sheep work, cattle work, craft, a variety of things. Now, so much of the work is being done by outsiders, and reflects like Graham and others have been saying.
We'll have to wind you up there, Bill. I'm sorry. Thanks. Bill Edwards, Norm Sheehan, to Graham Mundine and Trevor Leggett, Shane Blackman, Jackie Baxter, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.